On a hot Ionian afternoon, sometime in the 6th century BCE, an aging man stands on the harbor wall of Miletus, watching the sea. Ships creak at their moorings, merchants shout in several languages, and the air smells of tar, wool, and salt. For most people here, the sea is simply a way to earn a living. For him, it is something more, a clue. The waves, the changing tides, the clouds building offshore, the strange regularity beneath the chaos of wind and water, all of it suggests to him that the world is not ruled by the moods of gods, but by something steady, intelligible, and shared. His name is Thales of Miletus, and later ages will call him the first philosopher. To speak of Thales is to step into a world where myth and reason still share the same crowded streets. The Greeks have epic poetry, sacred stories, and rituals to explain the world. Zeus throws lightning. Poseidon shakes the earth. Apollo steers the sun. To question this is not only unusual, it is almost unheard of. Yet in the commercial, cosmopolitan port of Miletus, where ideas and goods arrive from Egypt, Phoenicia, Lydia, and beyond, it becomes possible for someone to ask an unsettling question. What if the world can be explained without resorting to myth at all? We know very little about Thales as a person, and almost nothing in his own words survives. What we have are fragments of stories, comments from later thinkers, and anecdotes that hover somewhere between history and legend. But reading between those scattered lines, a portrait emerges of an Ionian citizen who wandered widely, learned from other cultures, and began to look at nature with an eye that was neither priestly nor purely practical. He was not trying to placate divine powers. He was trying to understand how things work. One strand of the tradition remembers Thales as a traveler and observer. Later writers claim he spent time in Egypt, where he studied geometry from Egyptian surveyors who measured fields after the Nile floods. Whether or not this happened exactly as reported, it captures something important. Thales is curious about techniques that reveal order. The Egyptians used geometry to recover their property lines. Thales, according to the stories, uses similar thinking to measure what no surveyor's rope could reach. He is said to have calculated the height of a pyramid by comparing its shadow with his own, choosing the moment when his shadow equals his height, and then applying the same proportion to the pyramid's shadow. The tale may be embellished, but the idea is right. Nature can be probed with ratios, reasoning, and observation, instead of just appealing to the habits of gods. Another cluster of stories depicts Thales as the man who predicted a solar eclipse. Herodotus, writing about events decades after Thales' death, tells us that during a war between the Medes and the Lydians, the daylight suddenly failed and the battle stopped. Both sides saw the darkened sun as an omen from the heavens. Herodotus adds, almost casually, that Thales had predicted this event. Historically, this is difficult to verify. Eclipses repeat in complex cycles. And it is unlikely that anyone of that era could forecast a specific eclipse on a specific day using modern precision. But what matters philosophically is not whether Thales had an astronomer's chart in his hand. It is the image of someone who thought the sky itself was regular enough that one might at least foresee its patterns. The heavens are not a theater of divine caprice. They follow some hidden order. At the heart of Thales' reputation lies a simple, daring claim that all things ultimately come from water. Later philosophers will call this basic stuff the arche, the beginning or first principle of everything. On the surface, the claim seems naive. Modern readers may picture Thales saying, in effect, that rocks, trees, animals, stars, and human beings are really water in disguise, and then dismiss him as a childlike thinker at the dawn of philosophy. But if we put aside condescension and try to inhabit his world, the claim looks more subtle. For an Ionian watching the world carefully, water is everywhere. It falls from the sky as rain, collects in rivers and springs, surrounds the land as sea. It can be liquid, solid as ice, or vapor rising like breath from the warm earth. It nourishes crops, shapes coastlines, and seems to underlie life itself. If you live in a port city and travel by ship, you see how water connects lands and peoples. Unlike dry earth, water moves. Unlike air, it has weight and can be seen. It is not hard to imagine someone thinking, Perhaps beneath the apparent diversity of things, there is a single, shared substance, and water is the most plausible candidate. What makes this move revolutionary is not the choice of water as such, but the decision to look for any unified natural principle at all. Thales is not saying, Zeus chooses to make the sky the way it is, and Poseidon decides the sea. He is saying, there is something the same in all these differences, and we can say so in ordinary language. That step, from myth to rational explanation, is one of the decisive turns in the history of thought. It is the moment when the question changes from, which god did this, to what underlying thing or process produces this. Thales does not stop at metaphysics. He also seems to have held views about the divine that blur the line between God and nature. Later reports say that for Thales, all things are full of gods, and that he thought magnets have souls because they can move iron. These remarks sound primitive until we realize that he is grappling with a question that still haunts philosophy. How do we account for motion, life, and agency in a world that we suspect is fundamentally unified? If everything is water, how do we explain the difference between a stone and a living body, between a corpse and a breathing person? To say that all things are full of gods may be his way of insisting that the world is not a dead mechanism. There is something animating, something like a principle of life, immanent in things. The magnet seems alive because it initiates motion. Rather than imagining a distant anthropomorphic deity, Thales hints that whatever is divine is woven into nature itself. From the standpoint of later science, Thales's ideas are wrong in their specifics. The world is not made of water. Eclipses cannot be predicted by rough pattern alone, and magnets do not have souls. Yet his mistakes are creative, the kind that open possibilities. When we reconstruct the path his mind might have taken, we see him inventing new questions. If there is one underlying stuff, how does it change into different forms? If the heavens are regular enough to support prediction, what kind of structure must the sky have? If nature is animated, what is the source of that animation? These questions light the road that later thinkers will walk. The stories about Thales
also draw a picture of a man whose life stood at the intersection of theory and practice. One famous anecdote, repeated by Aristotle, tells of people mocking Thales for his impracticality. A philosopher, they say, is useless because he spends his time looking at the stars instead of paying attention to human needs. To answer this, Thales allegedly studies the stars, sees that the coming year will bring a rich olive harvest, and quietly leases all the local olive presses at a low price. When the bumper crop arrives, everyone suddenly needs presses, and Thales rents them out at a profit. He then offers this as proof that a philosopher could become rich if he wanted, but he has other priorities. The story may be embellished, but its moral is crisp. Philosophy is not useless. It simply aims at something more than money. Another ironic tale has Thales falling into a well because he is gazing at the sky, prompting a Thracian servant girl to laugh that he is so eager to know the things above that he fails to see what lies at his feet. The story survived because it is a perfect little allegory of the philosophical life. The thinker whose attention is on the widest patterns of being may in fact stumble over everyday obstacles. At the same time, the joke cuts both ways. The girl sees the immediate ground. Thales tries to see the ground of everything. Each is blind in a different direction. As the earliest Greek thinker later generations could point to, Thales became a kind of symbolic ancestor. By the time of Aristotle, merely 2 centuries after Thales's death, it had become common to organize philosophical history as a series of attempts to answer a question that Thales supposedly asked first. What is the basic underlying principle of the cosmos? Thales says water. Anaximander says the indefinite. Anaximenes says air. Heraclitus will later say fire and the logos. Parmenides will reject all change and speak of unchanging being. Behind these rival answers lies the same conceptual gesture. Assume that beneath the multiplicity of phenomena, there is some unity, and that a human mind can, in principle, name it. Thales lives in a city where practical intelligence is highly valued. Miletus is a hub of trade and politics, not a secluded monastery. The people who hear his ideas must balance them with the demands of the marketplace and the threats of nearby empires. In such a world, to say that everything is ultimately one substance is not an abstract game. It reshapes how citizens imagine their place in the wider order. If the sea, the river, the rain, and the body are manifestations of the same underlying thing, then the boundaries humans draw between one domain and another begin to look less absolute. The world becomes a continuous field instead of a patchwork of separate realms guarded by different gods. We can imagine Thales on an evening walk outside the city walls, watching the river twist through the fields. The same water that carried ships from foreign lands now irrigates barley and vines. Moisture rises as mist in the cool air. Far to the east, storms, rivers, and seas form a vast interconnected cycle that no one person can see in full, but which he intuits as a single process. To call that process water is not just to point at liquid. It is to name a cycle of transformations today described in terms of evaporation, condensation, and flow. Thales does not have our science, but he sees enough to suspect that what appears separate is, at some deeper level, continuous. His interest in unity extends beyond matter to explanation itself. Before thinkers like Thales, the world is narrated, not analyzed. It is told in stories of rival deities, each with their domain, their grudges, their alliances. Thunder, earthquakes, eclipses, plagues, each event is a message or weapon sent by some god. There is no reason to expect regularity or underlying structure. Thales begins to treat the world as a single system subject to shared principles. In doing so, he makes it possible to think of nature as lawful, even if he does not yet speak of laws. In Ethics and Politics, too, traces of Thales's thought survive. Later writers transmit short sayings attributed to him, gnomic little maxims that may have circulated in symposia and gatherings. Know yourself, one says. Another advises moderation, nothing in excess. Some say these belong not to Thales, but to the so-called Seven Sages, a semi-legendary group of early wise men. Whether or not Thales actually coined them, tradition links him to a style of wisdom that combines practical guidance with an awareness of human limits. The same person who speculates about the nature of all things also warns against arrogance and excess. Perhaps he understood that the human mind, in reaching for the archae of everything, risks forgetting its own frailty. From the vantage point of later philosophy, Thales looks like a distant ancestor whose face we know only through family stories. Plato mentions him only in passing, usually as the butt of the well anecdote. Aristotle treats him with more respect, quoting him as an example of early attempts to give material causes. The Hellenistic philosophers group him among the pre-Socratics, almost as a ceremonial starting line. Yet beneath this ritual placement lies something more serious. By choosing to speak about the world as a whole in terms that do not depend on the authority of priests or poets, Thales opened a space that would eventually be occupied by natural science. It is easy to underestimate how radical this space is. In a traditional culture, knowledge is anchored in revelation, myth, and custom. To question the stories is to question the community itself. Thales, however cautiously, begins to draw a distinction between what the stories say and what observation suggests. If an eclipse can be predicted, it loses some of its terror. If the Nile's flooding can be anticipated by measurements, it becomes a phenomenon to manage, not a mood of the gods. This shift is not just intellectual, it rearranges power. Priests, seers, and oracles do not disappear, but they no longer have a monopoly on understanding. A citizen with a good eye and a trained mind can offer an account of the world that competes with sacred traditions. At the same time, Thales does not simply annihilate the divine. When he says that all things are full of gods, he seems to sense that a purely mechanical picture of nature would be inadequate. The world he sees is vibrant, moving, self-transforming. The river is not a dead object, but a process. The magnet is not inert, but active. There is, in his thought, a tension between the drive to explain everything in terms of a single material principle and the intuition that there is something animating, perhaps sacred, in the very fabric of that material. Later philosophers will resolve this tension in different ways, some by banishing the divine from nature, others by equating the divine with the cosmos. Itself, Thales stands at the beginning of this argument, not yet forced to choose. When we place Thales alongside Heraclitus, who comes a little later, we can see more clearly what he began. Thales says, "Beneath all things, water." Heraclitus responds, "Beneath all things, fire and the logos, the law of change." Parmenides will then deny both, insisting that change is an illusion and that only unchanging being truly is. The entire drama of early Greek philosophy can be read as a series of attempts to do justice to the world's unity and diversity, stability and flux. Thales' simple image of water already contains the seeds of this drama. Water is one thing, yet it appears in many forms. It flows, and yet it maintains identity. It remains itself even as it dissolves and reshapes. In choosing water, Thales implicitly chooses a metaphor for transformation that others will radicalize. For the modern listener, especially someone beginning a journey into philosophy, Thales offers a double lesson. First, he shows that philosophy starts not with elaborate systems, but with simple, audacious questions. What is everything made of? Can the sky's behavior be anticipated? Is the world fundamentally one or many? Second, he reminds us that intellectual revolutions do not require perfect knowledge to begin. His answers are wrong by the standards of current science, but they are wrong in a way that makes new inquiry possible. To demand perfect accuracy before we begin thinking is to prevent thinking from starting at all. Imagine, finally, Thales, near the end of his life, sitting in the shade while younger Milesians discuss trade or politics nearby. Perhaps someone asks him what he has really accomplished. There are no books with his name on the cover, no institutional title like scientist or philosopher. Here's only a handful of sayings, some geometrical tricks, a disputed claim about an eclipse, an odd notion that magnets have souls, and the bold assertion that all is water. But somewhere in those scattered thoughts lies a quiet revolution. The world, he has suggested, can be approached as a coherent whole, intelligible to a finite human mind without secret revelation. We live, still, in the aftershocks of that suggestion. To begin the story of philosophy with Thales is therefore not just a matter of historical convenience. It is a way of honoring a particular shift in attitude toward the world. Before him, to ask why things are as they are was to rehearse a sacred narrative. After him, to ask why is to look outward with one's own eyes and to attempt, however crudely, to state a general principle. In that sense, each time someone looks at a familiar phenomenon, a wave breaking on a shore, a shadow stretching across the ground, a sudden darkening of the sky, and wonders whether there is some hidden regularity beneath it, Thales' gesture is repeated. The arche need no longer be water, but the desire to find it is his enduring legacy. There is another aspect of Thales that matters for anyone trying to understand why later Greeks look back to him with such affection. He stands at the very edge of literacy and public argument. The culture in which he moves is still dominated by spoken poetry, by epic singers reciting Homer and Hesiod, by oracles delivering riddling pronouncements. To suggest that the world can be examined through shared reasons rather than received stories is to invite a new kind of conversation. Instead of merely repeating a myth, one can propose a thesis that all is water and offer observations in its favor. Others are then free to agree, refine, or reject it. Intellectual life begins to look less like memorizing verses and more like joining a debate. Thales' city becomes, for a time, one of the places where such debates are possible, giving rise to what later writers will call the Milesian school. Even the political environment of Miletus plays a role in shaping his style of thought. The city is periodically under pressure from neighboring powers, pulled into alliances and conflicts with Lydia and Persia. Citizens must make decisions in assembly, balancing fear and hope, tradition and innovation. In such a setting, arguments about the nature of the world are not entirely separate from arguments about law and policy. To claim that there is an underlying order to nature is indirectly to suggest that human affairs might also be governed by intelligible patterns rather than sheer habit or divine whim. The same mind that looks for regularity in the motion of the stars may come to believe that justice, too, has a kind of structure that can be reasoned about. We can also dwell for a moment on what it meant, psychologically, to live with Thales's outlook. Imagine being raised on myths in which storms are sent by angry gods, in which monsters guard the edges of the earth, in which the safest response to disaster is sacrifice and supplication. Then imagine encountering an older man who says, gently but firmly, that the storm obeys something like a law, that eclipses follow a pattern, that rivers and seas participate in one continuous process. This does not remove fear. Ships still sink, crops still fail, but it alters its texture. Fear becomes curiosity's twin rather than its enemy. If there are patterns, they can be learned. If they can be learned, they can sometimes be anticipated. And if they can be anticipated, human beings are less helpless than they once thought. Thales invites his contemporaries to inhabit a world in which ignorance is not an eternal condition, but a challenge. His emphasis on observation suggests a particular kind of attention. Thales would have spent long hours watching shadows shorten and lengthen, noting when certain stars rose and set, tracking river levels, paying heed to the behavior of winds and clouds. This kind of sustained looking is itself a discipline. It trains patience and humility. The world does not reveal its structure at a glance. It must be watched, measured, compared. For a port city citizen, this skill has obvious practical benefits: better navigation, better timing of voyages, better planning for floods or droughts. But for Thales, it is also a path to something like wonder. The more one sees the regularities hidden within apparent disorder, the more the world feels at once familiar and astonishing. In modern terms, we might say that Thales helped shift the culture from a mythic consciousness to a proto-scientific one. But that would be only half true. He does not keep numbers, measurements, and predictions in one compartment and questions of meaning in another. For him, to say that all is water and that all things are full of gods is to speak about what the world is made of and how deeply alive it feels. There is no hard border yet between physics and spirituality. The same sea that can be described in terms of currents and tides can also be felt as something sacred. Later centuries will split these aspects apart, sometimes setting them against each other. In Thales, they still coexist. If we zoom out even farther, Thales becomes one figure in a broader human pattern. Many cultures arrive, sooner or later, at the thought that beneath the variety of things, there is some underlying unity. In India, early thinkers speak of Brahman as the ground of reality. In China, philosophers evoke the Tao as the way that moves through all things. Thales's water is less abstract than these, tied to a particular element, but the aspiration is similar: to name what pervades and connects. What is distinctively Greek about his move is that he expresses it in the plain language of a citizen and invites others to argue back. His arche is not a secret for initiates. It is a claim in the public square. From the perspective of your own time, listening centuries later, there is something strangely intimate about this ancient figure on the harbor wall. He has no telescope, no laboratory, no calculus. He does not know about atoms, galaxies, or microbes. Yet he has already begun to feel that the world might, in principle, make sense. When you look at a satellite image of clouds swirling over oceans, or when you read a forecast that predicts next week's weather with reasonable accuracy, you are inhabiting a worldview that takes for granted what Thales only glimpsed: that the sky and sea form a system governed by discoverable patterns. He stands at the very beginning of that confidence. There is a quiet courage in being the first to say aloud what many may have half-sensed but never articulated: that perhaps no divine temper must be appeased for the sun to rise, that perhaps the river flows according to its nature rather than in obedience to a god's whim. Such a statement risks misunderstanding. Some will hear it as impiety, others as foolishness, others as empty speculation. Thales's legacy suggests that he was willing to endure such reactions in order to preserve the possibility of a different relationship with the world, one in which explanation grows not from authority, but from observation and reasoned conjecture. It is fitting, then, that when later ages recount the lives of the so-called seven sages, Thales often appears among them as the one who looks furthest beyond immediate human concerns. Another sage might be praised for practical maxims or clever political maneuvers, but Thales is remembered for looking at the cosmos as a whole. Even his most practical stories, the olive presses, the measurement of pyramids, are told as if to reassure skeptical listeners that the stargazer was not merely dreaming. He could, if he chose, turn his understanding to profit and power. The fact that he rarely seems to do so is part of his charm. His curiosity is not a tool he uses for some other goal. It is the goal. In the end, we cannot reconstruct the exact sound of Thales's voice or the precise words with which he first announced that all is water. What we can sense is the mood his thought introduced into Greek culture, a mood of open-ended inquiry, of audacity tempered by observational discipline. Each time a later philosopher asks what the world is made of, each time a scientist proposes a unified theory that might explain diverse phenomena, the old Milesian's shadow falls across the discussion. His water has long since been replaced by more sophisticated candidates, but the desire to speak of an underlying principle remains. That desire, once released into the world, is hard to call back.
Midnight rails on her silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and let me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories. I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. The horizon gold, but it don't warm a lonesome soul. Every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain, where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be.
Mm-hmm.